thanks. Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here. It's so nice that we actually have, a semblance of a crowd. Tonight is the last Monday of the month in which we do assembly, working artist interviews, as part of Show and Tell Gallery here at Three Friends on Monday nights. And tonight I'm really, really pleased to introduce our candidate tonight is Susan DeFreitas. It's DeFreitas, right?
Is that DeFreitas?
DeFreitas, that makes sense. Okay. And Susan is a lot of things. She is a poet, she's a fiction writer, she's a nonfiction writer. She is also a writing coach and an editor. That's how she makes ends meet in between her what she publishes. And she's from Western Michigan. She spent a while in the Prescott area of Arizona, and she's been here in Portland for the last 4 years. She came here to go to Pacific University for her MFA. And she's a writer and an editor with a passion for science and literature. She likes to focus on the intersection between the natural world and the human heart. As I mentioned, she holds an MFA from Pacific and serves as an associate editor with Indigo Editing and Publications. And I'm really pleased to introduce her, and she's going to read whatever her heart desires for us. And then we'll get into asking her some questions and find out just how she balances all those things and keeps her creative juices going. Okay, Susan DeFreitas.
Well, thanks for that lovely introduction, and thank you, Rio, for having me. Thanks, friends, for trekking across town on this rainy Portland day. I'm going to read, those of you here who are writers know that, well, especially during this kind of long apprenticeship phase that we kind of have, publication acceptances are like birthday and Christmas all rolled up into one, right? They're kind of hard won and long time coming sort of feeling. So I have a few of those. I have a few things that have been published recently. So I just want to take a little a minute to kind of share some of these recent pieces. I'm going to read poetry because, even though I write in all three forms, I kind of feel like poetry is the form that is most, it lends itself to presentation, right? And plus, if you're going to get into fiction, you've got to really build it up and to some dramatic point and, It didn't seem like that. This was the best setting for that. So, whether you like it or not, I'm going to read you poetry. This is from a really nice anthology called The Lake Rises. Poems 2 and 4 are Bodies of Water. The Stockport Flats Press out of New York. This is edited by a friend of mine, Brandy Catherine Herrera, and her friend, Lisa, who has a Polish name that I can't pronounce. Please forgive me. But really quite a range of poems in here about water. And this one seems actually really quite appropriate to this this deluge that we've been under this weekend. And as I was walking home from the train stop this evening, a perfect, huge, vivid rainbow had appeared in the sky, and it was such a lovely moment, and I was kind of reminded of this piece right here. I can find it. This is called When the Rains Came. When the rains came and opened themselves to us, we did not care. We expected them there, like the strange angles of buildings and trees to which we had grown accustomed. The rains came with lightning, felling the trees and flooding our basements, flooding the city skies with light, obliterating stars. The rains came with blue and steady purpose, desolatory, washing our windows as if for change, making a mess of lawns. The rains came with the subtlety of pink darkness, Cocktails of apocalypse, riding shotgun with storms, these hot gases, the sweet breath of our own cars. Then one year, the rains failed. Us finally, and we all looked up as if for the first time, tearing at the light. How close the strange blue sky seemed, how far.
Thanks.
This is likewise a Portland poem. I think you can probably tell that I wrote that poem in the 4 years since I moved to Portland. Yeah? You do get flooding in the desert. You do get crazy, crazy monsoons. But they don't generally go on for 5 days at a time. A couple of the editors I work with at Indigo, we went out to Word Roundup in Pendleton, Oregon. Talk about the Far East, right? This is Eastern Oregon's writing conference is at the Indian Casino, the Wild Horse. You've probably seen some ads about it, which is just the perfect place for a writing conference, right? No culture clash at all between the people going there to gamble and the people going there to speak seriously of literary matters. But when we were driving back through the gorge, I swear it was like driving through a washing machine. I have never driven through rain like that before. We couldn't even see the side of the Columbia that was next to us as we were coming back. So, the rains. This is a Portland poem. This is kind of a love song to Portland, called Song for a City Number 3. And you know, you kind of get off on an idea as a poet. Maybe you have numbered poems, right, with the same title. But I don't actually know if there are two other Song for a City poems. So that may just be a really random designation now that it appeared in this journal as number 3. Maybe I should just never write or publish Song for a City 1 or 2, and it can just be very mysterious. This number 3. This is published in a little journal out of Chatham University in Pittsburgh called The Fourth River. It's a pretty cool publication. It's all place-based. And they take a pretty broad notion of that. So, stuff about cities, stuff about landscapes, stuff about being from places, travel. It was pretty cool. Okay. Anyways, Song for a City, number 3. I have resolved to say only awkward things to those I most admire. I will tell you, Matthew Dickman, about the difficult letter I wrote my mother this morning. I'll mention to Ursula K. Le Guin that my underwear is once again conspiring to kill me. To Colin Malloy, I'll say hello and goodbye. It is enough to know you are here in this city of eternal spring. It is enough that your heart holds up some part of this sky, that your shame is hot with love, that you've done the same drugs as I, said stupid things to people you liked, and hurled yourself endlessly at art. That you have taken it all to heart is what I'm saying. That you have been cruel and kind enough to know it. That the empathy you carry like a two-full book bag and still manage to wield like a weapon was packed in the dark morning of a winter's day. That you too walk to school alone but for this burden. I see your light in the face of Big Pink at sunset. I hear you in the teenage father standing in the street outside the shelter, screaming to God that he does not know himself. I am never alone when I am alone. even as I slip quietly across the park block bricks. Even as the pigeons scatter at my approach and then wheel close and turn a beady eye my way as if to say, hey. Across the eons of strange changes that separate our brains. The years of reaching from the outside in have left me with this pointless sympathy that is my greatest treasure. Your music in my head plays the bridges up an octave for each. Starting off with some indie rock ringtone at the Selwood, progressing to Morrissey at the Morrison, and ending in St. John's, audible only to angels. Elsewhere, you may be a style, a phenom, the subject of some cool critique, but here you are the city itself. It's every surface you've breached. Bits of your benevolence drift through the air in the hard light of autumn. I cannot avoid you anywhere I am. Read one more poem, and then maybe we can get into a little conversation here.
I'm just curious, did you bring Fear of Men?
I really did.
I really enjoyed that. If we have time, I'd love to read that, too.
Yeah, no, that was what I was going to read next, yeah. Well done. By popular request, I will be reading Fear of Men. I had one of these moments that, I don't know, in decades of pushing towards something like having a moment of feeling understood, maybe as a writer or connecting with an audience. I had this poem accepted by a journal called Heart online. And their mission is like promoting social justice through poetry. And I was like, cool, I'm down with that. But, you know, it didn't seem like a, I don't know, like a super prestigious thing. It seemed like a very grassroots, like, you know, few people with their hearts in the right place sort of thing. And I got this poem accepted, and I was very happy about that. And then when it came out, I was quite flabbergasted to find myself listed next to Terrence Hayes, who happens to have won the National Book Award in poetry, and one of my lifelong heroes, a poet named Tim Siebels. So any of you who are here who are like fans of poetry, I really would like to encourage you to check out the work of Tim Siebels. I think he's really quite a significant poet that not many people know about. In any case, I was really happy to be in such a gosh company, of course. And within the poem being up for a few days, I was so touched at the comments that this poem started getting, and it really seemed to open up the kind of conversation that I was meaningful. And that was very satisfying. And then when I started passing around this link, I found that all my friends seemed to want to pass it on to other people, and people that they passed it on to as well. And so it was one of those kind of rare and shining moments. I think we kind of labor in, well, I definitely labor in obscurity. But now and then, it's like the promise of writing is fulfilled, and this is definitely a moment like that for me. So this is called Fear of Men. One. When I was young, I had no fear of men, though of dogs I did. My grandfather, a gentleman with large hands, walked me every morning past the beast. That explosion of barking that broke the day, the fence that strained to contain it. Men, as far as I knew, were helpful. They fixed things, opened doors, jars, reached the canned peaches on the top shelf. Some days I feared my father, true, the way he could ignite without warning. But this was because he was my father. It did not occur to me that it was because he was a man, like my grandfather, who never raised his voice and patiently walked me to school each day past the thing I feared. 2. Fear of men is a learned thing. First, you must fear boys. Boys like cousins, always breaking bones, always setting things on fire. Boys tenderly holding each other's heads in the snowbank. Boys' arms and legs kicking and flailing. Boys swinging and missing, hitting and running. One boy I knew lay in wait each morning of sixth grade to taunt me, to run close like a firework, whistling with menace, and dart away again. I dreaded the new day, the way I was, whatever it was he had singled out about me. Felt like the mouse under the couch with the cat's eye always on me. Looking back, I suppose you could say maybe he liked me. 3. Junior high was a constant effort to keep boys from taking your clothes off. And everyone knows saying no all the time makes a girl feel like her mother. By ninth grade, we were tired. And besides, we were happy to give it up for our steady fellas, in part because they protected us from other boys. I'm not trying to say anything here. Except maybe if you were Catholic or unlucky, you'd be stuck with him forever. This guy who is basically your bodyguard. Plenty of nice girls did. 4. My husband is a gentleman. He produces jars of jelly from the top shelves for me, unscrews their lids if stuck. If I asked him, I bet he'd tie my shoes for me, the way my grandfather did. There is no sweetness greater than his way with children. And yet, he lives with a beast. I've seen it watching our quiet dinners, barking at the sliding glass door. That beast wants the glass to explode ecstatically, breaking the bone china, shattering that fussy sugar dish. The beast believes it wants to run the tundra and wolf down whatever it is fast enough to catch. But what it's really hungry for, and only now am I old enough to know this, is a wide open space at the edge of town, where it can hiss past at a safe distance and explode gloriously in the air, where it can burn itself off and disappear. But how can it when I'm always right here? 5.
Suspense.
5. I do not like this fear of men. On the street, in the park, in the parking lot, after dark. I do not like it when one approaches me walking and I must look away. I dislike it especially when he is black, because perhaps he thinks his being black, the fact of that, has something to do with this. Sisters, listen. Eye contact with a man of any color can be hazardous to your health. Something in them catches fire, then it's your job to put it out. And when your car is robbed, the catalytic converter lifted, when the gunshots fire in the distance, when the bottle is broken in the alley, when a child is forced to do what a woman does when a woman is, my sweet boy children, it's all men. And they walk, I think, in fear of each other. 6. I am tired of this fear of men. I think men too are tired. Tired of inventing acceptable excuses to touch one another. Tired of extracting the shrapnel of other men from the bodies of women. Tired of the vigilance required to protect their daughters. Tired of murders. They are tired of being beaten, and they are tired of doing the beating. Tired of being jumped in and tired of jumping. Tired of the love they carry but dare not speak or name. Someday, maybe, the beast in the brain, that animal, will have its room to run. And our boy babies with their lovely bodies will no longer leave us for war. And out in a glorious field somewhere, those men who cannot help but break our hearts will do so at a distance, burning off their arsenals singly and together in a great glittering display. And our fathers and brothers and husbands and lovers will watch those heroic explosions, maybe the way they do the Super Bowl, with something akin to longing, then turn to us and offer us their large hands to hold on that long journey home.
We're just going to share the mic here. I'm just going to lower it so we can sit if you like. First of all, before I even say anything, does anybody have any comments that they'd like to make or questions?
Pressure.
No? Okay. All right, so as this is about balancing creativity and making art and making money, how do you feel that you maintain a balance, since they're not always the same thing? What is it you do to keep doing? I mean, you're lucky enough to be, as an editor, at least you're in writing, so you don't get so far away from it. I mean, I love editing, and I think it's actually kind of creative sometimes, and you get to be around creativity, mm-hmm. so you're never getting very far, mm-hmm. but you know, it's hard to find the time, it's hard to find the juice. What do you do?
Well, you know, I think when we talk about balancing art and money, I think probably the best way to address that is not just what I do now or what an average day looks like. I think it's more useful to talk about the journey of how you get to something that's a little more balanced on the side of making money from art. Because I think we tend to have the idea that people just come into that, right? And some people do, you know, they publish some, they work while they're, you know, they write the great American novel while they're, you know, between their shifts making espresso. And then they, you know, they blow up and all of a sudden they're like living the dream, right? They're making money writing books or doing their art. But I think that is a relatively rare sector of the artistic population, right? So my journey was, you know, coming out of school, and again, I want to speak to the journey because writing is so long. The apprenticeship period is so damn long. I mean, I've wanted nothing more than to be a writer since I was probably 8 years old, and now nearly 30 years later, I feel like I'm just starting to get a toehold into kind of living that dream a little bit. So, you know, I started off in advertising, right? So I was a nonprofit arts administrator in my 20s. I took a job that nobody else was crazy enough to take. I did it for love. I didn't make much money, but I was working close to the arts. And I kind of funded that. I worked for a little magazine, writing a column once a month for maybe $50. But then I wound up selling advertising to kind of help keep the magazine afloat, right? So I had this nonprofit arts job, and I sold advertising. And I kind of began to figure out that and this is the thing, I feel like an entire generation of people who want to write are writing business articles on the web. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
This is like how Google finds you, right? It needs this like endless mill of content, articles written and rewritten on subjects that you and I probably have no interest in whatsoever, right? But from advertising, I found that I could work online and write articles. And so I kind of intersected with the world of business that way, right? But I was getting closer. I was getting closer to writing. I wasn't working in the bagel shop anymore, right? And so from there, I decided to go back to school to get my MFA. And when I came to Portland, it was like a Craigslist ad, right? They wanted somebody to cover green technology for a news website that was coming up. So that was a little more interesting than the article writing, right? Little closer. It wasn't like my own creativity, right? But I could bring some creativity to it. So I moved in that direction. And then when I was kind of in the midst of grad school, I had a great stroke of luck to kind of to meet the Allie McCart, who is the senior editor of Indigo Editing. And I kind of talked her into like, oh, you know, you want somebody to help with editing poetry, and by the way, if you need somebody for fantasy and sci-fi, basically being a hustler, right? You know, trying to find some way that I can be useful to this person. And so from there, you know, there was an opportunity to teach. So I think basically what I'm trying to say is that you don't have to know how to get where you want to be. You just have to keep moving closer to it out of what's available to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And also, I think what I hear you saying is that you, your balance seems to be that you were going to pay your bills first as long as it was in the field that you wanted to be close to. So you just did whatever you could for the money as long as it was getting you closer and closer to you. In other words, you had a goal. The way you balance it is you have a goal.
I always had a goal, and this is a thing too that I think my mother thought was kind of hilarious, was that through my 20s as a freelancer, I did advertising, copywriting, and stuff too. But as I got better, I was able to increase my hourly rate as a freelancer, right? And as I did that, I just worked less and less hours. I never really made more money. I just made more time for myself to write creatively, which is kind of not the American ideal, right? You're supposed to like have this steadily increasing salary, you know, as you get older. But I actually, as much as I could, I kept my expenses as low as possible and made time to write. So
would you say that from the get-go your goal always was to be a writer, and kind of like a lot of actors say, you know, you just take the jobs that come because you just have to keep working as long as you're still acting. Like, you know, some people say, no, you have to watch your, that you only take the right roles, and other people are like, just keep working. You know?
Yeah,
so
you seem
to belong to that latter category, but yet at the same time, it does seem like you kept honing and re-honing your vision. Kind of, you talked about that in your blog, that you had a whole post about the writing is rewriting. You talked about how it's all about the iteration, and
yeah.
So it sounds to me that like your writing style is a lot like your personal style as well.
Great observation.
Yeah. Well, do you think so?
I don't know. I mean, again, my conception is that I had no idea how to achieve this thing called being a writer. But I did know that writing about wind turbines was more interesting to me and more creative than writing about, business-to-business marketing, right? So it was always about moving a little closer to the big dream in any way that I could. And also keeping things loose enough to recognize what was close.
That's interesting. Can you define that a little better? How do you mean keeping things loose enough to realize what was close?
Well, it's nice to stay with the security of a job.
I see what you're saying.
Right?
Okay.
But if you worship too much at the altar of security, you kind of sacrifice opportunity, right? But, you know, it's not like you really have much choice as like a kind of gig-to-gig freelancer or whatever.
Right,
we're
right.
kind of naturally scrappy
yeah, you have to
sort of hustlers, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
And as far as, like, only taking the ideal roles, I think that's great if you don't have to feed yourself.
Well,
or you have something
I'm so
doing
curious
that for you.
To, I want to ferret out what this, it looks like it was almost like a semi-conscious goal, but definitely a goal. What was it that you wanted to be a quote-unquote serious writer, that you wanted to be a more artistic writer? There must have been something fueling you closer to the wind turbines and away from the business to business.
Well, sure. I mean, the goal was always to be a meaningful writer,
Okay.
All right. To connect on a level that was meaningful to me and also to other people. And also, honestly, to open up conversation. I'm a glutton for, you know, for good conversation. So I've always wanted to write about all these things that were pushing on me from the inside, that I wanted to find the other people who were possessed of this same feeling.
Were you writing fiction before you went to school?
Yeah.
You were.
Yeah.
You mentioned on your blog that you have one, you have one story, Spin,
yeah.
that finally just got published, yeah, in
yes.
Bayou Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You said you'd been working on it for 15 years.
Yeah. I mean, don't you love it when people say that? Because you just imagine this crazed writer just all day, every day, working on this story that, like, comes out compressed like a diamond. No, it's just a story that, like, I have definitely revised it more than anything else I've ever written. And it was always like kind of a litmus for how far I've come, right? Because every time I revised it, I polished it as far as I could get it. To me, within like an inch of its life, this thing is a burnished jewel. And then I'd come back to it a few years later and be like, right? So I could see beyond what I had done before. The actual architecture of the story, the idea of the story, never lost its hold on me.
Well, that's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I have this one short story that I wrote, and I found the iteration process really fascinating.
Uh-huh.
You know, I found it wonderful in and of itself, and then I just really began to be sick to death of this stupid story. I can't really imagine unearthing it over and over again,
yeah.
year after year. What was it that kept its hold on you?
There's something about, I don't know. I feel like I may be the slowest learner on earth when it comes to writing fiction. Like, I used to aspire to writing great literature. I now aspire to writing competent fiction. And as a reader for Tin House, I actually realize at this point in my life how rare that actually is, competent fiction in terms of submissions to literary journals. But I really think there's something to, I always bit off more than I can chew, always. I always had a huge idea that was so far beyond my abilities as a writer to land it. But there's really something to that though, because those questions you can't quite answer, that shape that just eludes you, that paradox you will never get tired of wrestling with, it holds a lot of juice for a long time, you know? And I think eventually you become a big enough writer to accommodate your vision. If you don't give up and, you know, you're kind of stupid enough to keep butting your head up against the wall.
That's a good description. Basically, you have to be, you know, brave enough and clear enough to hold that vision, and then the vision keeps pulling you along in your work as you then, I like that, you become big enough to manifest your vision.
And you know, part of that is that, you know, for those of you who have suffered through fiction workshops, they can be wonderful, you know, but, you know, a lot of times, those aren't the successful stories. Those are not the stories that, you know, the instructor praises and that everybody likes. You know, those deep, weird, hugely ambitious, you're not going to get this right on the first three tries kind of story. Those often are not the most successful ones in a workshop setting. So that's just something to maybe encourage yourself if you have ever felt like you were seized by this vision and you knew how great it was, and then you just realized that you just did not get it, and everybody could see that you did not get it.
I haven't sat through a lot of fiction workshops, but is that your experience personally, or everybody
yes.
else is in the workshop as well? Okay.
That is my experience personally.
Okay, all right. Because, I mean, you know, I'm just wondering if there's, you know, a few people out there who go in and do a workshop and then, you know, that's it. That's the story that puts them on the map. It might be.
Yeah, I've really envied people who are like, you know, I just like to write. I don't really know what to write about, you know? Maybe I'll just write something with a first-person narrator and they're looking back at their life. That sounds kind of cool. Folks who can, like, just take tools and weave stories out of, like, their interest in craft. Mine has always been backwards. I have always had this story that I don't know how to get at that I then just throw tools of craft at and, you know, hope something happens. Hope the nut breaks apart.
Do these stories kind of arise spontaneously, or is it something that's niggling at you and then the story grows out of that? There's some idea that spawns it.
I'm one of those people who suffers from the idea plague. Mm-hmm. Anybody else here have like a giant backlog of ideas? Like the rest, you could live four lifetimes and you'll never exhaust them? Yeah, I'm like that. And I don't tend to lose track of them. What with, you know, again, that's where obsession is kind of an occupational prerequisite, I think. So I'm kind of more these days trying to experiment with just making stuff up. But most of the things that I've write, I've in fiction, I've had on my mind for years.
Really? Okay.
Whereas poetry I write about what's on my mind before breakfast.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think that's one of the reasons why I'll never be a fiction writer, is I just don't have any burning ideas really. But it's interesting that you're talking about these you had one post that I really liked was this brilliant quote by Flannery O'Connor that I think truly she absolutely nails what is going on with young writers, because that's certainly, she's described me in a nutshell. And this is from her book, Mystery and Manners, and Susan has it on one of her posts. She says that young writers are not, they're conscious of problems. The beginners are always reformers, she said. They're conscious of problems, not people, of questions and issues, not of the texture of existence, of case histories, and of everything that has a sociological smack. Instead of all those concrete details of life that make actual the mystery. And then you go on to talk about how those concrete deals of making those real is subjective, given that, you know, nothing is really as it seems, so what seems concrete isn't. So it's really, it's up for grabs how you want to interpret that. And then I would like you to explore on this nice quote from you, where you go on to say that the central mystery is a story that could mean almost anything. Our failure to exploit it as artists strikes me as a failure of the imagination. Do you want to expand on that?
Sure, yeah, okay. Long-standing area of obsession is the scientific creation story, right? According to, you know, our best guess at this time, a lot of people who are really smart have been trying to, have allied a lot of resources around trying to figure out how we got here, right? And back in, you know, in our great, far back history, are all of our myths. We had origin myths to explain how, you know, the world got here and how we wound up in it. And they were great stories. But right now we have a really great story that kind of says, first there was nothing, right? Then there was something. And then something was matter, right? And then out of matter came life, and out of life came mind, came us, right? And I just think that is absolutely outrageous. I mean, that is the story of stuff, as far as we can tell. And we act like that's not religious. We act like that doesn't have spiritual dimensions. We act like, or we act like that means one thing. Whereas stories are not set. That can mean anything, right? But right now, there's not a lot of people in the meaning-making business who pay that much attention to science, right? And I'm making a very broad generalization there. But writers are in the meaning-making business.
So you think that is a responsibility of artists, then, to make meaning?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I think it is how we make meaning is through the arts, period. I think that's what we do for humanity. I feel like we are that function of the collective brain.
Anybody have any comments about that?
No, I'm just supporting you.
Well, yes, okay. I appreciate the support.
I agree. No,
solidarity.
Let's have some comments at this point. Yes, Aaron.
You said religion, but what you're suggesting is metaphysics.
Yes.
So we all speak to energy, but that's a complete juxtaposition. It's against religion. It would mean that we're all a hive mind and we're evolving to one thing.
That's my religion.
Nice. Very good.
Anybody else have any interjections at this point? Some thoughts during this?
I had a question earlier. How do you know those people in the workshops aren't the ones that have the backgrounds, the stories? That your actual concentrating on the story in the first place is more important than, oh, I'm going to do this technical exercise.
You know, I appreciate you so much for suggesting that, and I take great comfort in you saying that. And in fact, you know, that's probably some part of me. I definitely believe that because it's convenient for me to believe that, and it makes me feel better about myself as a human. But honestly, I think we all have our own pathway to art, you know?
Well, no, it's true.
And people come at it from different angles, you know, and some guy who in your workshop who strikes you is like, who's that wanker, right? You're never impressed with anything he really had to offer, and it didn't have great feedback or whatever. I really kind of believe, like, 10 years out, if that guy keeps doing it, he may just be struck by lightning and produce something of great consequence to the culture. Might. These things happen. Like, creativity just kind of sweeps through us through, like, this hive mind thing, right? So there's no accounting for taste. There's no accounting for sincerity. There's no accounting for how you come to it. It's just now and then you hit pay dirt. And if you're in the right place at the right time, maybe you came through it through a concentration on craft. You know, maybe you have a near-death experience, or maybe you've been just banging your head against the wall for 15 years. Like, it's mysterious, you know? Yeah.
You said something about how you feel about yourself. That was something I was thinking. You're talking about you have all these insecurities, but for the most part, I think you come on like a pretty confident person. Clearly, you felt that you were worthy of this vision, and like you said, you're a hustler, and you are very, very committed, and, you know, so you must have a pretty good sense of yourself and your worth. When that slides a little bit, does that affect your writing? Do you wait until you feel better about yourself, or do you write anyway regardless?
No, I don't wait till I feel anyway at all. I just do it every day. And here's the thing, too. There's really, like, it takes a giant ego to sustain yourself as a writer through this immensely long apprenticeship period. Like, if you didn't believe you had something earth-shattering to say, why would you do it for hours every day in the face of, like, very little encouragement from the world, right? You have to believe in yourself. So, I mean, So it's really shocking sometimes when the world does not come back at you with all this love and accolades and, you know, feedback that you are as great as you seem to yourself, right? But I think as you go on, you learn to internalize your own sense of confidence and also just accept that the world is what it is and that everybody has these visions. Everybody feels that important to themselves. And they are, right? And here's the thing, too, is that, I don't know, has anybody seen Ira Glass? Of course, he's the announcer for This American Life. Has anybody seen his lecture series? Well, it's interviews on creativity.
Oh, I've heard about him, but I haven't, no.
You know, he said, I wish somebody had told this to me when I was starting out. And I think he's done a great service to all of us who are kind of starting out by saying it. He said, nobody ever tells you when you're starting off as a writer and storyteller. They tell you that you're talented. You're not talented. I don't even believe in talent. He says what you have is taste. You have good taste, right? You have great taste. You have highly charged opinions about what you like and you don't like, right? And that's what it is that's leading you forward, right? And so that's always your taste. If you have good taste, you're always going to feel like you're falling short, right? Because somebody else whose taste maybe isn't as good, they can't even tell that what they're writing sucks. But you can tell, right? That's why it feels so daunting. And his whole thing is, you just have to produce in quantity. You just have to produce so much creative work. You know, your 10,000 hours or whatever, right? In any discipline, supposedly leads to mastery. So I believe in 10,000 hours far more than I believe in talent.
How many hours a day do you write?
3 or 4.
Even when you're editing?
Yeah.
Do you do that 8 hours a day? Do you do that 40 hours a week? Or is it?
I have never been employed at 40 hours a week.
Lucky you.
Well, again, I've never made that much money. And that's been
right,
like
you
a...
You don't make much money working 40 hours a week.
A pretty conscious decision is that at every point where I could increase my hourly wage as a freelancer, and the freelancer, you take a lot of risk. You have to hustle for your next job. You never know where it's going to come from. Sometimes your deadbeat clients don't even pay, right? I mean, there's a lot of risk associated with it, but that's part of the reward of it is that you can charge, you can set your hourly rate. So again, at every point that I could, I increased the amount that I got paid per hour and I decreased the number of hours that I worked. And now it's pretty much about half and half.
That's very smart. I get this daily morning, what does she call it? Morning meditations for writers or some morning motivations for writers. That's what it is. Linda Formicelli has. I love that blog. That's exactly what she says. Just for those of you who came in the last 15 minutes or so, we're interviewing Susan DeFreitas. Her work is being featured in Southwestern American Literature, Sin Fronteras, The Bear Deluxe. What is it? The Bear Deluxe Weber? Is that all one word?
No,
Bear
Deluxe. This is one.
Weber, The Contemporary West. God, I need my glasses. Bayou Magazine and the Outhernais Reader, and she is an editor at Indigo Editing here in town. And didn't you say you're also a reader for Tin House Magazine. So, let's see. Does anybody have anything they'd like to contribute? I'd like to get some feedback from, all you people who are obviously interested in what you're hearing. Come on, people, you're all creative. Come up, create a question. You can do it.
Fear of Man was great. That was a great poem.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
I share the same. I feel the same way about the opposite sex. It's a little bit of a feminine ideal, but I'm afraid of women as well.
Thank you for admitting it publicly.
Yeah, I get receipts, so no one called the cops on me. I always have an alibi,
Receipts?
I don't want to get caught, so I buy something every 15 minutes. No eye contact with this guy. Yeah. But it was great.
Cool, thank you. Well, that felt like a really risky poem to write.
No, it's worth it.
And here's the thing, was that I was like, well, who the hell am I to write a poem about fear of men, because I've been surrounded with like top quality men like pretty much my whole life. Like, my dad's awesome, my grandpa's awesome, my husband's awesome. Even like all my ex, I mean, we weren't compatible, but I don't have anything disparaging to say about any of them. I think they're all pretty extraordinary guys. And yet there's this kind of institutionalized thing that I've always felt as part of just like a personal and spiritual ideal is that I like to be open to people, right? I like to be open to strangers. I like to be kind of free moving in society. And it's always seemed really weird to me about all the ways that you're supposed to protect yourself as a woman and also what those things are connected to, right? And then also, I just kind of traced it back. I'm pretty close with my cousin now, who lives in Portland. And we actually live half a block away from each other. But quite honestly, I don't remember having an intelligible conversation with him until he was like 15. As a kid, he was just like this
all boy. Like, he was just like the Tasmanian devil, right? Him and his best friend. I just felt like if I was like spent too much time around them, I was gonna wind up like, you know, something was gonna break, some shrapnel was gonna fly, right? And it was just really interesting to me how we meet across this kind of gulf of like, we kind of separate off as kids and then we meet as adults across the genders. And I'm just always interested in what brings us together and what holds us apart, you know? And I would almost say that is just dedicated to all the awesome men that I know, because what that poem's talking about, there's only one guy who read it in all the interwebs that got spread around who really was offended by it. And that just like really broke my heart, because again, I felt such a risk in writing it. Like, I did not want to make any guy feel like I was particularly afraid of him, right? But what was awesome was that I got so much positive response from guys, right? And so, I don't know, it really just felt like reaching out and making contact, you know, in a very human way, which was the idea behind it.
You had something else, one of your posts that I like. You talked about how you like to use different tools for writing, which, and of course this is a common theme with writers. Some people only write in longhand, some writers. Some love, as you mentioned, a manual typewriter. Others, you know, have to do everything on a word processor. So, but you said you'd gotten into doing voice recording as a starting place. And what, now to me, you know, I have that idea too, because I'm always talking to myself, quite literally.
Okay.
And so one of the reasons why I want to do more writing is get those ideas out of my head and out of my voice and onto paper. But the minute I put the recorder in front of my face, I suffer from the same problem that you do when you're staring at the screen. So how does staring at GarageBand differ from staring at a blank Word document?
Well, here I'm going to admit something that might make me seem, well, probably as crazy as I am, but I think at this point I have written 2/3 of a novel all via dictation.
Wow.
There's not a single word of it that's been written down. And it's kind of an experiment. It was funny, my good friend Lisa and I, we took a weekend, our little writing retreat at the Oregon Writers Colony. By the way, if you don't know what that is and you're a writer, you should check that out, because that's an awesome resource. You can go and stay at this great beach house on the coast for really cheap. Anyways, and I was like, this is it. We're gonna crack open the first audio file, you know? I haven't like heard any of it. This is like I felt like I was like uncorking like my homemade wine or something, you know? And we gathered together and I pushed play and we were both just like, huh? I sounded like I was asleep, which I kind of was, because the way the book started off was that I was laying in bed in this kind of half-awake, lucid state. I think I was actually hungover.
Might have something to
and
do with
that. And the first word, I had this story in my mind, and I wanted to work on it, but I felt like such hell, I couldn't even move. And I was like, that's okay, I'm just going to write this in my head, and I did. So I came up with, like, 4 sentences, right? It's not that hard to come up with 4 sentences. And I just recorded them. That's it. I was like, you know what? What? I mean, 4 sentences a day, that eventually turns into something, right? And so, God help me, I did. And I've since shared with Lisa that I did go back and listen to some other further along audio files, and they're not nearly as incoherent and sleepy. But that, the blinking eye of the recorder being like the blinking cursor
it doesn't have the same kind of like mind-numbing pressure on you as the...
Well, here's the thing. My friend Brandy Herrera, she tried it, and she went into like, yeah, I'm just talking a poem, I'm just talking through the poem, I'm just making it up as I go along. And I don't do that. I sit and when I started off, I thought of the 4 sentences. But at this point, I stand and I say them to myself. I listen to the last piece of it, I stop it, I come up with four more sentences, or however much occurs to me, and I repeat it. I repeat it to myself until it sounds okay to me, until it's kind of smooth. And again, we're talking like a few sentences. And then I hit record, and I record that.
Okay, so you rehearse it and then record it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Oh, I like it. I'd like to try that myself, actually. I'm just, I don't know, getting garage. By the time I get GarageBand up, I'm already distracted, though.
Are there any poets in this audience?
I think everybody is, isn't there?
Aren't they? Well, only a few who'll admit it.
Oh, this is Portland. Everybody admits to being a poet.
But really, if you think about it, if I don't know if you've ever worked on a poem in your head. It's a good way to do it, and especially if you're really oriented towards rhythm and sound, which most poets are, right? And I forget, I was reading one poet, she was a mother. She's like a woman in her 70s now. But she said that's how she wrote poetry when she had young kids, was that when she had a few minutes free, she would work on a poem in her mind and smooth it out that way. And you can do that with a couple sentences. It's not that hard, right? So for anybody who feels like, oh, I never have time to write, you know, I have to have 2 hours. I found it was something I could do in 15 minutes a day. And it eventually turns into a book.
I think that's brilliant. I love that idea. Unfortunately, we are at the close of this hour. We're going to go into the open mic now that follows. And I thank you all very much for coming. And I thank Susan DeFreitas for DeFreitas. I'll retrain my mouth at some point. For joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you all so much.
I'm going to put my name on there.